What does Earth Day mean to you? For the people who organized the first Earth Day in 1970, it was revolutionary.
I figured, oh my God, we've unleashed some powerful new force now on American life. And it turned out to be true.
Earth Day started a movement that led to cleaner air, cleaner water, and put the environment front and center. On today's show, we're looking at Earth Day and how a single day changed so much. Plus, who invented the phrase Earth Day?
He would always say, Earth Day, birthday. It was easy. That was his entire explanation for how he came up with it.
The history of Earth Day. That's coming up on a special Allegheny Front. Please stay with us. This is the Allegheny Front special Earth Day show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
And I'm Reed Frazier. And I might not be sitting in this chair today if it weren't for Earth Day. That's because before the first Earth Day, things like environmental journalism didn't exist. But we'll get to that later.
20 million people participated in the first Earth Day in 1970, and now it's celebrated around the world. In 192 countries, in schools, small towns, big cities, you name it. And everyone has their own way to mark the day. In Pittsburgh at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, the Climate and Urban Systems Partnership is testing out new activities that they'll debut at an event on the week of Earth Day. Educator Pat McShay hands out wooden spoons with red plastic salamanders glued to the tops and magnets attached to the bottom. It's kind of a fishing game. Inside a plastic container are leaves and pictures of insects.
So you can pretend you're a hungry salamander and just poke through there with your spoons and see if you can catch something to eat. If things are in balance, very good. There's a bunch. If things are in balance, there should be plenty of leaves, plenty of bugs, and plenty of salamanders. And that would be a very, very good situation for keeping our air clean.
Meanwhile, in Ohio, musicians Hal Walker and Maurice Drake sit side by side on a piano bench in Walker's living room. They're rehearsing for an Earth Day presentation at a local school near the town of Kent.
I am reaching out in peace. I am reaching out in peace. I am reaching out in peace within an opening circle.
Now, usually he does a harmonica or a little solo.
Ah, the sounds of Earth Day. Sounds kind of groovy, actually. But let's rewind back to the time before the first Earth Day. There is no Environmental Protection Agency, no Clean Air Act. The word crisis is used a lot when describing the state of the environment.
This planet is threatened with destruction, and we who live in it with death. The heavens reek, the waters below are foul, children die in infancy, and we and the world which is our home live on the brink of nuclear annihilation. We are in a crisis of survival.
That was Barry Commoner, a famous biologist, from a CBS news report that aired on April 22, 1970. Commoner was involved with that first Earth Day, and so were many other people, like Senator Gaylord Nelson. To learn more, I spoke with Adam Rome. He wrote the book, The Genius of Earth Day. Adam Rome says Senator Nelson was really the father of the event.
Nelson's story itself, I think, is just amazing. He had been governor of Wisconsin in the late 50s and early 60s and had begun to be interested in environmental issues then. But by the time he was elected to the Senate, he had decided that the environment was the great challenge of the 60s of the decade. He introduced legislation in the Senate dealing with big issues of the day like pesticides and water pollution, and that none of them passed. He finally had the idea for what became Earth Day in late 1969. There had been a disastrous oil spill off Santa Barbara, California, and he had been out there to see it. And when he was flying back to Washington, he read an article about a tactic that the anti-Vietnam War movement had used earlier in the decade to raise awareness and to really spark action, and that was the teach-in, a kind of politicized extracurricular events on campuses. He thought the same thing about the environment could really energize and empower people. And so he called for this nationwide environmental teach-in. He hired a small staff of 20-something people to help him when his Senate staff was overwhelmed by the interest. But really, thousands and thousands of local organizers around the country made Earth Day happen.
I was struck by the diversity of the types of people that were brought together, the organizers for the first Earth Day. There were housewives and students, politicians, but even people from industry and business were involved.
Nelson, he was a liberal Democrat, but he didn't try to make Earth Day into anything in particular ideologically. In fact, he went out of his way to make it bipartisan. He asked a congressman, Republican congressman from California, to be the co-national chairman of Earth Day. So there were some places where Earth Day was more hippie-ish, more radical, on some of the more radical college campuses. But there were other places where it was a very conservative event, where no one was doing flamboyant protests, where they were trying to talk soberly about the issues. Housewives were very important for a lot of reasons. This was a chance for them to do something politically, to do something outside the home, but often to protect the health and well-being of their family and their community, which was very important. Professors were important, and students, needless to say. But as you mentioned, there were a lot of business people. There were labor leaders. The United Auto Workers was a huge supporter at the national level and in many local events as well. Walter Reuther, the head of the UAW, resolved that they were going to make the environment a bargaining issue. They weren't happy about making cars that were huge air polluters. Unfortunately, Reuther died in a plane crash just a few weeks after Earth Day and never was able to continue what he had begun to do.
The national press, which covered Earth Day in 1970, characterized it as largely a symbolic event. Your book suggests until Earth Day, there was no modern environmental movement. For example, it helped spawn environmental nonprofits around the country, and it was the impetus for environmental study programs at universities. How was this one event so influential?
Earth Day gave the environmental movement a name. It brought together, literally, often on the same stage, activists who had worked separately before. You know, air pollution, none of the national conservation organizations worked on that. That was all local organizations like Stamp Out Smog in L.A. And all of a sudden, people who had worked on wilderness or who had worked on air pollution or water pollution or pesticides or sprawl suddenly began to think that these issues weren't separate. They were all part of a big environmental crisis. That was the phrase everybody used. And then, as you said, it leads to all kinds of really specific institutional changes that helped make the environmental movement powerful in an ongoing way. Publishers suddenly see there's a huge market. A librarian at the Library of Congress said, you know, the year after Earth Day, more books about the environment came out than in the whole previous history of the U.S., which was an exaggeration, but it was still clearly indicating the trend. And after Earth Day, there's this tidal wave of environmental legislation, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, you name it, that probably wouldn't have happened, or certainly not so quick and uncontroversial a form without Earth Day.
Is that tied to the sort of birth of environmental law and lobbying that came into its own after Earth Day?
There really were no environmental lobbyists before 1970. But after Earth Day, several organizations, including the 20-somethings who Nelson hired, they decide that they want to stay in business, and they create something called Environmental Action. They amassed a list of thousands and thousands of these local organizers and these newly created local organizations that had come into existence in order to make Earth Day happen. And they made them into a lobbying force.
Your book is called The Genius of Earth Day, and I was going to ask you why. What is the genius of Earth Day?
Well, I think one part of the genius of Earth Day was the organization of it, which brought together the power of the Washington establishment that Gaylord Nelson represented with the unbelievable creativity and energy of the grassroots.
What can today's environmental groups or activists or anybody interested in the environment learn from the first Earth Day?
The very professionalization of the environmental movement, I think, has made it harder for people to think broadly about how the environmental issues connect to all kinds of other things that people are concerned about. In 1970, a lot of the Earth Day organizers really wanted to make sure that people didn't think of the environment as some separate special interest, that they saw it as intimately related to their thoughts about their family and their community and their work, as well as the other big issues of the day. And so I think that's something, especially with climate change, which is way, way bigger than an environmental issue. Thinking of it only as an environmental issue dramatically limits the number of people who will care about it or do anything about it. And I don't think the organized environmental movement has done as good a job as it might trying to get people to think more broadly about what's really at stake and why they should care and what they're willing to do.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's been a real pleasure.
Adam Rome's an environmental historian at the University of Delaware. He wrote the book, The Genius of Earth Day, and you can see historical prints and photographs from the first Earth Day from his book at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
And I'm Reed Frazier.
I'm Patty DeMarco. I am a visiting researcher and writer at Carnegie Mellon University. Background as a biologist, and I've been working in energy and environmental policy for most of my professional life. The first Earth Day, I was still a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh, and I was teaching a course as a teaching assistant. So we had this class, and it met Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So on the Wednesday, it was actually the 22nd of April, and we had the TAs give the course that day. So we did a teach-in and opened it to the public, to, you know, the whole campus. And we planned this for like weeks. We had this big weather balloon that we blew up and painted with faces all over. And so at the beginning of the class, we started pumping up this balloon, and somebody started reading the Begats from Genesis, you know, and talking about how the population was growing and growing. And while they're reading this long passage, the balloon got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then we had on three walls slide projection. I realized you didn't have the media that we have today. So on one side, we started showing air pollution. On another side, we started showing water pollution. And on the front, population pressure and land pollution, cities. I, at one point, was taking pictures for these. And I got out of my car while I'm commuting into Pittsburgh with my dad. I jumped out of the car while we were in the traffic getting into the Liberty Tunnel. And I took a picture down the line of cars with all the exhaust pipes. You know, Patricia, get back in the car. You're going to get run over. Like, I need this picture. You know, it's like, it was really fun. But we blew all the fuses. The place was not wired to deal with all of that. And then in the end, all of the screens went to the atomic bomb. And we set off sulfur bombs in the back of the room that flowed down, so everyone felt the pollution, although outside wasn't all that much better than inside in those days, and left people with a sense of, this is what we're doing to our earth. We have this, you know, beautiful earth full of living creatures that we are ruining. And it was pretty powerful. I mean, people left feeling really with a different perspective, and that was our objective. I think that was the beginning of my own awareness of how much the public did not understand about the environment. And I think we're facing the same kind of situation today, although the pollution that we're facing is not as visible.
Do you have memories of Earth Day? Share them with us on Twitter using the hashtag AFEarthDay. Find us at Allegheny Front. One image that's burned into people's minds from the era of that first Earth Day is Cleveland's Cuyahoga River on fire. In 1969, photos of the fire went viral, as we'd say today.
It was the symbol of out-of-control pollution. Many think it led directly to the passage of the Clean Water Act. Here's the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant with more on this iconic river.
At the time of the first Earth Day, the Cuyahoga River was long a pollution problem. As early as 1881, Cleveland was a major industrial city, and the mayor then called the river an open sewer through the center of the city. This is from a film made by WKYC-TV in 1967.
The Cuyahoga River, as it reaches Lake Erie after a 100-mile twisting and turning journey from its headwaters, is an exhausted stream, abused and misused by man and his machines.
The word Cuyahoga means crooked. When you look at a map, the Crooked River takes a U-shape, beginning in northeastern Geauga County, running south and west through Akron, and then turning back up north to Cleveland. And in the late 60s, those last few miles leading to Lake Erie, the banks were lined with steel mills and factories. The riverbed was filled with shipping boats.
By this time, the waters of the Crooked River are legally dead.
But in the late 60s, there still hadn't been much action to stop it.
What I really remember was going out on the, I think at that time it was the Good Time One. It's a boat that takes people on river and Lake Erie tours.
Frank Greenland of the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District grew up in Cleveland.
And there were fairly huge algal blooms going on at that time and a lot of dead fish in pockets, a lot of dead and dying fish. Not a great memory.
Environmental activist Elaine Marsh remembers her first visit to Lake Erie and the river this way.
There were all kinds of signs. No swimming, no boating, use at your own risk, polluted water. It didn't even look like water. It looked like oil and grease and paint.
Tim Donovan tended ships in Cleveland's port back then. He spoke with Cleveland State University for an oral history project.
When you were working down on the river at that time, the river was like a cauldron. It would just bubble up, oxygen trying to get out of the river. It had a coat of oil on it. And you'd see rats float down the river the size of dogs, bloated from whatever it was that they ingested. And there was a rule that if you fell in the river, you immediately went to the emergency room in the hospital. So the idea here was don't fall in the river.
Most people blamed industry. There were the steel mills and Standard Oil, chemical and petrochemical companies. They all lined the Cuyahoga in the 60s. Ben Stefanski stands by the river today, remembering when he was a young man, only 28, and had been hired as utilities director of Cleveland.
All of the industries, including Akron, just dumped their waste in the river, untreated. That was what the river was there for. We didn't think about the future.
For Stefanski and many others, that changed on June 22, 1969. That's the day the Cuyahoga River caught fire. The river had burned at least a dozen times before, costing millions and even killing five people. But 1969 was different. Newly elected President Richard Nixon was prioritizing environmental quality to deal with air and water pollution. And people were rising up around the country for other reasons, to protest the Vietnam War. And in Cleveland, there were race riots. Stefanski says there was one major reason the Cuyahoga fire got so much attention.
The mayor was Mayor Carl Stokes. The national press had their reporters here 24 hours a day because he was a unique character, you know, black mayor of a major city. So anything that happened in the city, no matter how small it was, it became reported by the press because they were living here, so they had to tell the story.
A few months after the fire, Time magazine picked up the story and ran a photo of an earlier, much worse fire. Elaine Marsh, who helped found Friends of the Crooked River, says that's when Cleveland's burning water shot to national prominence.
I think when the rest of the country sort of looked at it, it was a river catching fire was just, that's it. That's over the top. Something has to be done.
The young Cleveland utilities director, Ben Stefanski, watched Mayor Stokes use the attention to raise money to clean up the water.
Well, Carl became a national spokesman, so he went to Washington. It was before Congress. He was from Cleveland, the city that had dirty water. Plus, he was a black person, too, so he represented that whole community that was in the inner city, that lived along the lake and the rivers.
Later that same year, Congress passed the National Environmental Policy Act, the precursor to the Environmental Protection Agency, created the following year, in 1970. Elaine Marsh remembers the first Earth Day in April 1970. She was setting up a table for the Sierra Club at the University of Akron. She expected few people to show up, but she says they kept coming.
Church groups, school groups, Cub Scouts, Girl Scouts. You know, I mean, it was really amazing. I thought it was going to be like four or five tables of people, the usual suspects of people I knew. And I was really astonished to see all of the people who were so interested and active.
The city of Cleveland hosted what was called Environmental Crisis Week around Earth Day. Historian David Stradling has just published a book called Where the River Burned about the Cuyahoga. He says Mayor Stokes did not attend Earth Day events for a variety of reasons.
And he does call politicians kind of frauds on Earth Day being out there making speeches about the importance of investing in the environment, and at the same time going back to Washington and dedicating very little funding for this very purpose.
President Nixon, for one, generally supported environmental cleanup, but he vetoed a bill passed by Congress to create national water quality standards because of the high price tag. Congress overrode his veto, creating what's known today as the Clean Water Act. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Take a picture here. Take a souvenir. Cuyahoga. Cuyahoga.
And you can see a video about that famous fire on the Cuyahoga River at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. So as we learned earlier, Earth Day was the brainchild of Senator Gaylord Nelson. But Nelson didn't come up with the name Earth Day.
Those two powerful words were the work of legendary New York copywriter Julian Koenig. And if you're over a certain age, you've almost certainly seen or heard his work.
Timex, it takes a licking and keeps on ticking.
This was one of many ad campaigns dreamed up by Julian Koenig. He wrote some of the most successful ads of the 20th century. The most successful, actually, according to a list of the top 100 ads compiled by Ad Age magazine.
The number one ad, the top of the 100 list, Think Small. That was Volkswagen's American campaign to sell the Beetle in 1959, and my father wrote it.
That's from an episode of This American Life that first aired in 2009. Regular public radio listeners will recognize the voice, Sarah Koenig. She's a producer for This American Life and host of the podcast, the hit podcast, Serial. And she was Julian Koenig's daughter. The 2009 story she produced focused on her father's career in advertising and about a long feud he had with one of his partners. She told me her father was sharp, insouciant, someone who shared his opinions freely.
My dad was really, like, very blunt and persuasive in his opinions about stuff. I mean, he had great taste, kind of beautiful taste, actually. And he made it clear that, like, there were good ideas and then there were not good ideas. And he knew what the good ideas were.
Though Koenig and his partner, George Lois, would clash over who was responsible for some of their firm's most significant work, everyone agrees. Julian Koenig came up with Earth Day. So how did one of the world's great advertisers get involved with the biggest environmental demonstration in history? Julian Koenig is in the Copywriting Hall of Fame. He was even name-dropped by Don Draper on an episode of Mad Men. Sarah Koenig says her father got interested in the environment in the 1960s after a trip he and her mother took to East Africa.
I don't know if that was kind of an eye-opening thing for him. I mean, he was like a city kid from New York.
He did an ad campaign to save the Serengeti and started a short-lived environmental magazine. It was around this time that a group of students and conservationists were organizing a nationwide event to call attention to the environment. Historian Adam Rome wrote a book about Earth Day. He said at the time, organizers were calling it an environmental teach-in.
They all thought that environmental teach-in was a loser of a name, and that it sounded too academic, that it didn't sound action-oriented.
Enter Julian Koenig. Koenig approached the organizers with an offer to work for free. Dennis Hayes was the young national director for the event.
Initially, we didn't even know who he was, but then did a little bit of digging and found that he was one of the real players in American advertising.
Koenig gave the group a list of choices for what to call the event.
One of them was for Earth Day. One of them was for E-Day. one, I think it was for Ecology Day, but he made it clear that he thought that the one that worked best was Earth Day.
Sarah Koenig said it didn't take long for her dad to figure out what to call the event. It was scheduled for April 22nd, 1970. As it happens, that was his birthday.
He would always say, Earth Day, birthday. It was easy. That was his entire explanation for how he came up with it.
Dennis Hayes said the name was key to bringing people in. This event wasn't going to be a debate or a lesson.
If you're starting to talk about human ecosystems and biomes, you relatively quickly put your audience to sleep. We needed some way to describe this that would resonate immediately and people would know what it is you're talking about. And Earth Day did accomplish that for us.
The group placed an ad in the New York Times with a cutout coupon for people to send back with donations. It became the rare ad that paid for itself. And it helped the event achieve a massive turnout. 20 million people, by most estimates, from all walks of life.
I figured, oh my God, we've unleashed some powerful new force now on American life. And it turned out to be true.
Sarah Koenig says Earth Day typified the kind of thing her father would come up with all the time.
It's very much in, like, that just Earth Day is very typical of my dad's work and his best work, which is just very spare, very smart, very classy, very simple, you know, but simple but smart. I mean, think small, right? Like, that's his most famous line. It's two words.
For her dad, his work helping invent Earth Day balanced some of his negative feelings about his profession.
You know, by a lot of people, still, he's considered the best copywriter who ever lived, right? Like, he was really a master of it. Obviously, he was proud of that. He was proud that he was good at it. On the other hand, he was like, I spent my life selling to people. And he wasn't proud of that part.
In her 2009 interview for This American Life, she got her dad to talk about his career.
Advertising is built on puffery, on, at heart, deception. And I don't think anybody can go proudly into the next world with a career built on deception, even though no matter how well they do it.
But there was one bit of advertising Julian Koenig did feel good about. Here he is talking with his daughter, Sarah Koenig, in a portion of that 2009 interview that did not make it onto the air.
Well, Earth Day is one of the things when my children say, what did you do in the Great War, Grandpa? I'll say, well, I wrote Timex, It Takes a Licking and Keeps on Ticking, and I wrote Things Small and the first Volkswagen advertising, and I named Earth Day.
Julian Koenig passed away in 2014 at the age of 93. Whether you know his name or not, Julian Koenig gave the environmental movement a symbol to rally around, a brand. And no one knew the power of that better than the man who gave Earth Day its name.
Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front's Earth Day Special. I'm Carol Holzapfel.
And I'm Reed Frazier. Special thanks today to Ben Schmidt and ZBrand for their help with the advertising story, Zach Falk, and Sarah Koenig. Our executive producer is the flower child, Kathy Naur.
Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.